listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome again to another episode of the Arab American Identity with Dr. Hani Bawardi. Dr. Hani Bawardi, welcome.
Thank you.
We have reached to our fourth episode, leaving last time with the Paris conference, the first Arab conference in Paris. Can you talk to us more about that, Doctor?
Yeah, so this is a time when the Arab nationalists, wherever they were, expecting or anticipating the start of World War I, which came as no surprise. I think we mentioned that last time. They found an opening to voice their political aspirations to the whole world. And by that time, there were several secret and public nationalist organizations with different declared goals. For example, the Ottoman Decentralization Committee, or in Arabic, Hizb al-Merkezi al-Idari al-Othmani, which was public and centered in, headquartered in Cairo, in the safety of Cairo, away from Sultan Abdul Hamid, who was keen on stemming out, or snuffing out, actually, all those movements. And there was Al-Arabi al-Fatat, or the Young Arab, which was a secret society, headquartered in Montpellier, France, we think, whose members were so secret, we don't know all of them to this day. Some were declared by George Antonius in his seminal book, Arab Awakening. So they met in Paris, and the immigrants were major participants in that conference.
Doctor, question before we go on. Mm-hmm. The Sultan Abdul Hamid, the Ottomans' intent of suppressing these movements, was it out of fear of Arab identity or out of fear of rebellion against their rule? Meaning, did they have an agenda against establishing or empowering an Arab identity, or they just wanted to protect themselves from any resistance or opposition or intents of separation?
Well, rising Arab national and cultural demands seems to have given rise to what amounts to a rebellion. So there were secret and public societies that actually began to express their displeasure with Ottomans. By this time, especially after suspension of the Ottoman constitution to the second time in 1909. It was resurrected in 1908, 1909. The Young Turks, or the junta, sort of embarked on a policy of Turkification, which kind of breathed even new life urgency in the efforts to achieve independence. Now, most scholars, which basically the scholarship in English language tips towards Western, you know, perspectives, they don't buy that. They say they're having a hard time believing that Arabs were articulate, cohesive, national, cultural, political collective of sorts. Yeah? Albeit there were, to some extent, disparate loyalties here and there, but the core demands began to take shape. They were articulate. And yes, the Ottomans were not keen on that at all, because it would have meant that they would have to give up Bilad al-Sham or geographical Syria, which will weaken them. This was a large population and a strategically critical area between East and West. And they knew that. They did not want to give up any autonomy, least of all, let alone self-rule. So they began to kill, basically, those who are vocal, especially with the start of World War One, as early as 1914. Throughout the war, they killed dozens of Arab nationalists, regardless of their religion or geographical area. So, but before that happened, before World War One started, the Arab nationalists knew that they have to make the case for themselves. But they were very savvy about it. So Abdul Hamid al-Zahrawi, Shukri al-Asali, Abdul Ghani al-Uraisi, let's not anglicize those names too much, al-Asali, al-Uraisi, al-Zahrawi, those were among the leaders of this nationalist movement, some of whom, both al-Asali and al-Uraisi, served in the Ottoman parliament, as a matter of fact. But those people began to articulate very savvy, very intelligent agenda based on the secret agenda of the Arab, the young Arab, or Al-Arab al-Fatat. In fact, Al-Arab al-Fatat were a major force behind this convention or meeting in Paris in 1913, mm-hmm. aka the first Arab conference in Paris in 1913. And they knew by then, very well, that the immigrants in the diaspora in North America and in South America, as well as in Europe, parts of Europe and elsewhere, had the same goals. And they invited them to participate, to bring emissaries, which they did. So in addition to the above and many, many others, Najib Diab, editor of Mir'at al-Gharb, attended on behalf of the United Syrian Society. Mm-hmm. Per capita, I believe, the largest, most organized, non-sectarian Syrian-American organization, which raised money to fight immigration battles. We don't know much about it. I have a single document, actually two documents, with the letterhead and the writing, the name of the United Syrian Society. That's how little we know about it. I'm not aware of any more out there. Amina Rehani may have been at the conference, but I have yet to document that. So, at the conference, there was an in-depth interview in the Leto, or the Times, the French newspaper, L-E-T-E-M-P-S, with Abdul Hamid al-Zahrawi about the goals of the conferees, basically, the attendees. And he articulated those. And he, in so many words, said, well, we don't want the Ottoman Empire to disappear, but we would like to gain autonomy within this Ottoman shell. Secretly, however, and I have documentation to that effect from the period, as a matter of fact, they hashed out plans to achieve complete independence in stages. First, autonomy, and then self-rule, and then complete national independence, as this secret document shows, which became the bylaws, as a matter of fact, of the first formal political organization in the diaspora named Free Syria Society. There were others before it, after it, but this one had structure, it had chapters, and very illustrious members among its ranks.
By the way, Doctor, some of the names given to this same conference is the first Palestinian conference, the first Arab Congress, and the Arab Syrian Congress.
Yeah, I think the first Arab Congress in Paris is the most accurate because, I mean, when you say Palestinian, yes, there were Palestinian emissaries, but they conceived of themselves as Syrian representatives, not Palestinian. Mm-hmm. So, and this is a critical point. I'm glad you raised namely that they were unified in asking for geographic Syria as the future state. They knew Egypt had a different national trajectory now. It's, in fact, under British occupation since 1882. And they knew that the French and the British are eyeing Lebanon and Palestine. It was no secret. They wrote in the Arab American press, the Syrian American press, extensively about that. One of those articles was by Mikhail Naimi, titled Palestine, a Jewish Kingdom, in which he actually said as much that, you know, the French are trying to, are making too many promises to the Europe, to Europe's Jewish population to create a home for them in Palestine. This was many years before the Balfour Declaration, 1917, as you can, as you noticed, 4 years prior to that, in fact. So the French and the British were going in that direction, and they were looking for ways to govern the provinces they would gain from the Ottoman Empire, because the area is a key onto the east, where their rich colonies are, but also is very close to the Suez Canal, which is critically important for the British and the French. In fact, it was built by, you know, Egyptian labor. Thousands died building it. But the ones who own it, stock, lock, and barrel, are British and French investors who were also parliamentarians. It's a very corrupt affair. And they loaned the Khedewi, or the governor of Egypt, Khedewi Ismail, they loaned him a lot of money, like £1 million, to have this big party. That's when they commissioned the opera Aida for the celebration, which did not take place on time. And he could not repay them, so they took his shares in the Suez Canal. That's how they conducted business. This is to the British. Wow. It's all business, I mean, to the British. And the French were very similar in their attitude as well. So, but they spelled out their views as such: autonomy, leave the Ottoman Empire intact, and find ways to gain independence. They had a good reason for doing that, which escapes most Western scholars, unfortunately. That is, they knew if the Ottoman Empire collapsed, that colonialism will soon follow and will move in to fill the gap. They knew that very well. And that's precisely what happened.
And that's prior to World War One.
Yes, absolutely.
So it was clear to them that the Ottoman Empire is falling and failing at any rate.
True. It was declining, absolutely, but it had fight in it still. In fact, they proved that, the Ottomans, during World War One in Gallipoli. They did maintain their territorial integrity, so there was some... It was not a foregone conclusion that they would collapse. The outcome of the war would have been, you know, a crapshoot in some respects. You never know how it went. But they knew that if the Allies won, and the, especially the Francophones and the Anglophones among the nationalists, they were not keen on being ruled by Europeans, never chose that, not for a hot second. But they knew that they wanted to modernize, and the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So they said, okay, maybe we don't want colonialism to move in. We'll maintain the Ottoman Empire. But if, should it fail, we have to take sides.
Right. And they were planning to do this, if not peacefully, by militant rebellion.
Interesting you should mention that. Here is what Abdul Hamid al-Zahrawi said in so many words. He issued a warning. I mean, his attitude towards the Ottomans were, okay, we want autonomy. Okay, we don't want to make you our enemy. We go back ways. He had no friendly words to say to the Ottomans. But, you know, couched in his remarks was a warning to the West, to Europe, that if you move in and colonize us, we'll have a different conversation, meaning we will bump back. We will resist.
Interesting.
So that warning was issued to the French and the British more so than the Ottomans. The Ottomans were carrying on with their own plans. They didn't care either way. But he wanted to tell the West, like, we'll do business with you. We're keen on modernization. We're not backward. We're forward-looking people. Among us are many who were educated in the Sorbonne and here and there. And here are the immigrants, and hence the importance of the immigrants, that namely look, they live in the States. They think the way you do. They are Americans, American Syrians, and they too want independence. And on their turn, in turn, the Americans in their own press, along with, you know, very nuanced language, warning of all these dangers, they were also saying, okay, we can plant the seeds of democracy, mm-hmm. American democracy in the Middle East. You saw traces of that.
Right. So, Doctor, I see this conference as a beginning of a very important initiative. If it was successful and it gathered all the factors for its momentum, it would have probably had, and I don't know if you agree with that statement or not, it would have had a very strong effect as much as the Jewish Congress that the Herzl has formed, or the results of the American Revolution or the French Revolution. It seemed to be with the same spirit, and I'm not surprised that it was, and you know, it was held in France. I want to quote here the editor of the and the Lebanese League of Progress president, Naum Kharzal, who said in the conference, the revolution must be literary and reformist.
Yeah.
Only the last resort should it be bloody, because the political systems of free nations have been constructed by martyrs and not with printer's ink.
Yeah. Well, I have a serious problem with the veracity of anything Naum Kharzal says. We've been able to document that he is an agent for the French. He talked the talk. He gave a very small speech. But consider this. It was not he who represented the diaspora in North America. Mm-hmm. It was Najib Diab. Mm-hmm. So Naum Kharzal...
What brought him? Who invited him?
He came on his own accord. He mm-hmm. was sponsored by the French. In mm-hmm. fact...
So Fatah did not invite him?
Oh, absolutely not. He was actually antagonistic towards Arab nationalism in general. Mm-hmm. And he was a proponent of carving out the Beirut area, Mutasarrafiyya, or mm-hmm. the district of Beirut, out of Syria entirely.
So what's his intention of attending?
To promote, behind the words of Lebanese progress, notice the word Lebanese. I mean, the Lebanon, to everyone else, mm-hmm. with no exceptions,
was Syria.
Was part of Syria. Mm-hmm. They would say, the Lebanon. I am from the Lebanon. If you ask them, so what are you? They would say, I'm Syrian. Mm-hmm. You could say, I'm Lebanese, but that does not preclude being subsumed by Syrian identity, except when it came to a very small band of people mm-hmm. around Naum Kharzal. Mm-hmm. For people interested in this more, there is a huge book, a couple of them, by Muhammad Zuaiter, called Al Maroniya fi Lebanon. So the Maronites basically were partisan to French intervention,
right?
Which was completely anathema or opposite of what the mm-hmm. nationalists were calling for. Mm-hmm. The more substantial speech came from Najib Diab. But it also worth mentioning that there were letters and telegrams sent in support of the core demands of the conference from all over the world, from all parts of Europe, Asia, all parts of the Middle East, from Morocco to the Sudan, Egypt, Libya, everywhere in between, mm-hmm. and Palestine, which sent emissaries, of course, as Assyrian emissaries, and of course from North and South America. So there was no confusion about, you know, Lebanon being set aside for France. That's the French, that's what they wanted to do.
That's an undermining of the conference's intentions, of the conference organizers' intentions, wouldn't you say?
It is, but the way he did his worst, Naum Kharzal, is that he engaged in an exchange of epithet and really degenerate language mm-hmm. on the pages of Al-Huda.
I saw that in details in your book, The Making of the Arab American Identity. And it was shocking and it was sad because it's such a waste of very important and scarce efforts. They were being wasted in internal struggle. Just recapping the conference, the first Arab conference in France, Doctor. So 1913, before World War One, before the fall of the Ottoman Empire, before the full division of the area by colonialism in our area, there was an Arab awakening. There was a nationalistic identity being formed. It surrounded the Syrian identity. It had a very close eye at what's going on in Palestine in terms of the Zionist movement, which brought more urgency to its cause. And they met in Paris in 1913 to establish that aspiration to form a national identity. I mean, to express their national identity.
So that identity, it should be mentioned since you're recapping, is an outgrowth or an extension to what we call Nahda or awakening, which began as a cultural affair and became increasingly political with specific national demands, which all came together in 1913.
Unfortunately, World War One happened.
Yes.
This was the first Arab Congress, and there was no second Arab Congress. There was no second meeting to that meeting.
Whatever meetings that are subsequent to this had to contend with a changing reality, and they were fragmented. Because very soon after World War One, the area was divided between the French and the British, precisely what the convention participants feared would happen in 1913 and before that even.
If it wasn't for World War One and the change of the shape of Earth during that time, what would you think would have been the results of that effort?
Well, there's no clear indication that the nationalists would have been able to purge the Ottomans from Syria. The Ottoman army was far more powerful than anything they can put together. And Egypt was out of the equation. In fact, if you go back a century prior or so, Mehmet Ali's efforts, almost a century, Mehmet Ali's efforts as the governor of Egypt were thwarted by the British, the French, and the Ottomans, so that he doesn't become powerful. We talked last time about him sending his sons, Ibrahim.
Muhammad Ali Basha. Ibrahim Basha.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Who marched on Istanbul, reached all the way to Konya, but then had to retreat. So it's not clear what would have happened. I suspect eventually the Ottomans may have, I mean, historians don't like to guess or imagine scenarios,
right,
but maybe the Ottomans would have conceded to an autonomous region to quiet them down. Beyond that, you don't know what might have happened. Could have been like an Arab province of the Ottoman Empire, or eventually some kind of a Turkish federation. We don't know. But it is a fluid situation. That's why the question is worth pondering. Culturally, religiously, Arabs and Ottomans and Turks have much in common.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Islam was a common denominator, it's really difficult to rule out completely. However, people should keep in mind that should never be exaggerated. In fact, when World War One began, the Turks issued what they called a jihad, call to jihad, and no one in the Arab world answered their call. Maybe few diehards who figured they are the guardians of Islam and may have been willing to fight for them. There may be a considerable number who felt that way. But the thrust of the development, social, economic, cultural, political, says otherwise. In fact, in 1915, a year after the war began, the British initiated contact with the Sharif of Mecca, Sharif Hussein of Mecca. And they told him, if you fight for us, basically, in a series of letters, if you fight with us against the Turks, we promise you to give you Syria as your independent country. And there was no question that Palestine would have been part of that Syria, or southern Syria, as one newspaper was titled, as a matter of fact, in Palestine. So, but that was, and that's exactly what happened. But the British never delivered on their promise. In 1916, the Arabs of the Hejaz, or Western Saudi Arabia, declared their revolt against the Ottomans and marched northward. So the Ottomans were flanked on the east of the Jordan River by the Arab army of the Arabs of the Hejaz, and on the west side of the River Jordan by the British army. Allenby led that army. And they met in Jerusalem, and the Arabs kept marching all the way to Syria, to Damascus, where they declared their state. And they had, as a matter of fact, the Kingdom of Syria for 2 short years after the war, until the French, of course, put an end to that.
Malik Faisal.
Yes, Faisal is actually the son of
Malik Hussein,
the Sharif Hussein of Mecca. In fact, he was accepted by most of the leaders of tribes, not all of them, of course, but most of them. He became king, King Faisal. It didn't last very long, of course, because the British and the French, 1 year after they made those promises, the British especially, in 1916, 1 year after they made all those promises in the what is known as Hussein McMahon correspondence or McMahon correspondence, they actually signed a secret agreement with the French called the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which spelled out in details how they would share the territories, you know, direct French control over Lebanon, centered in Beirut, extending all the way to the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf, if you will, and then north of that, a zone of influence as a buffer against the Turks. And south of that, another buffer to keep themselves out of each other's, off each other's throats, as it were, the British and the French. For the British, a buffer zone in the British, for the British, south of that, and then a direct control extending from Palestine all the way to the Persian Gulf again. And after the war, they just made a small adjustment, you know.
And the story of the Lawrence of Arabia, D.H. Lawrence, summarizes, or maybe...
Well, he's actually... Lawrence of Arabia is the film, and the book are the film that could have been more than anything else. The Arabs of the Hejaz were accomplished statesmen. We cannot take that away from them. They knew what they want. They had the savvy and the patience to navigate the British. We did not need Lawrence of Arabia to mobilize and march, as the movie or this, you know, narrative suggests.
This is an important commentary on the novel and the movie, because many Arab youth in the West, sometimes they seek references to Arab history from stories such as Lawrence of Arabia.
And this is part of a glut, a copious amount of writings that say, you know, more or less the same thing. We call it Orientalist discourse. You know, like as if we don't know ourselves until a Westerner comes and explains us. And somehow we're just too generous and by letting that happen as long as it did. And we still do, by the way. In our own community, we do these
things. And we will get to a certain point in our series where we're going to talk about, we're going to have a whole episode about Orientalism. And perhaps one of the last questions we're going to ask in this series is, is there an aspiration for a second Arab conference that can maybe carry our new aspirations as Arab nationalists, waking up from the from the aftermath of colonialism and Sykes Biko and the Arab-Israeli conflict, etc. It seems that since the fall of the Ottoman Empire or since World War One, our area has not been out of crisis since then. Maybe in the West we've had a little bit more peace that we can gather our thoughts, and that's why this is a very important series that stems the talk about Arab American identity from the formation of the Arab identity or the perception of the Arab identity, because Arab American identity has to do a lot with, you know, it's part of the same circulation, yeah, of the same blood.
Yeah, well, yeah, as the Arab identity. That's why it's important to talk about, you know, Arab narrative on Arab's terms to understand Arab American identity. But since you mentioned that, I think one way of looking at this without, you know, jumping the gun, is that in my mind, the Arab world is picking up with the Arab Spring where we left off after World War One. In fact, we can talk about this in more, you know, considered way in more details to kind of trace the steps and figure out how not much changed, and that the Arab Spring, one of the things you notice at the dawn of the Arab Spring is a map of the Arab world without any borders, delineating borders from one country and the next. And unfortunately, we moved away from that. So I don't know what's going to happen to our conversation.
Right. Even movements that were awakened by also conflict and sometimes by external interference, such as ISIS, even them, they had the mention of Sykes and Biko in their recruitment videos. They had the talking about Islamic identity rather than Arab identity. One video actually showed a person crossing from Iraq to Syria, saying that we have deleted these borders that were drawn by Sykes Biko.
Yeah, so, unfortunately, it took someone like that to pick up the slack, but
right,
that speaks to the general failures in the post-colonial experiment, shall
exactly.
we say.
It is dangerous not to fill those gaps because they can be used by such organizations
for their own purposes. Absolutely.
Their own purposes. Doctor, we want to wrap up this episode with the Arab identity, where we have reached to it right now. We started from the early 19th century, and now we are after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. We're moving to the United States to start talking about the Arab American identity. Is there anything else you want to add to the Arab identity that is now on the ships immigrating to the United States?
Yeah. I may have mentioned this before, but the core message I have based on research or an indisputable fact is that part of their baggage they bring with them to the new world was aspirations of a free, independent Syria within its natural borders, as we described them.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, dear listeners. This is the fourth episode of the Arab American Identity. We will start next episode with the Arab American Identity and the early immigrants to the to America. With that, please follow us on Dearborn Blog, or this is also published on the Muslimish Freethinkers. Follow us on the blog. Please leave your comments, your questions, your feedback. Your comments and feedback will be incorporated into the upcoming episodes. This is Raw and Uncut. Thank you, Dr. Bawardi, again, and we will see you in the next episode.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at Muslimish.org.